Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the C. Henry Smith Peace Oratorical Contest. I'm Nancy Heisey, and I am a member of the Bible and Religion faculty and the seminary faculty here at EMU. And the Bible and Religion Department, together with the Department of Applied Social Sciences and Language and Literature Department, host this C. Henry Smith contest each year. So I want to thank, first of all, my stalwart teammates, Vi Dutcher, Chair of Language and Literature, and Gloria Rhodes, Chair of Applied Social Sciences, and also Barb Beyer, our able and our assistant who has kept us sane as we prepared. The Smith Contest was established in 1974 by the directors of the C. Henry Smith Trust as a way of honoring this Mennonite historian who taught at both Goshen and Bluffton. Smith is well known for many books on Mennonite history and his particular attention to the peace commitments of the Mennonite tradition. The contest is administered annually by Mennonite Central Committee, and students from Mennonite and Brethren in Christ colleges in the U.S. and Canada are eligible to participate. Since 2003, EMU has participated in the binational contest in all but 2 years. EMU students won the binational prize 5 times and most recently have placed second in the binational in 2014 and 2017. We're especially grateful for our judges this year, and they are James Richardson, who's assistant professor of music here at EMU. He's serving as the convener of the judges. As noted in his title, he's a well-known baritone, and he's widely in demand for concert performances. He also has a lot of experience in forensic judging. Irvin Stutzman is completing 10 years as executive director of Mennonite Church USA in May. He also served before that as dean here at Eastern Mennonite Seminary. He's an experienced preacher, and he has a PhD in rhetoric, so he's also eminently qualified to serve as a judge. Johanna Turner is assistant professor of restorative justice and peace building at the Center for Justice and Peace Building. She has a PhD in American studies, a graduate certificate in youth ministry, and wide experience. If I started to tell you all the many ways that she's engaged with young adults and processes of peacemaking and justice, it would be the speech of the evening. So each of our judges is bringing really exciting and important skills to their consideration of what you've prepared. So let's thank the judges. This year we have 7 contestants, and each of them has prepared a speech that applies the Christian peace position to a contemporary issue. You will have the program with their names here, but they have drawn numbers, so I'm going to give you the order in which they will proceed. So if you want to mark your program, number 1 is Kyle Good, number 2, Amanda Williams, number 3 is Katrina Poplett, number 4 is Lydia Haggard, number 5, Winifred Gray Johnson, number 6, Caleb Schrockhurst, and number 7, Fabian Espinal. So that will be in the order in which we will proceed. After each of the speeches, we will give the judges time to record notes and comments. And during this period, you're free to chat, get up, stretch. There are refreshments outside the door, so you can move around during that time. However, when the judges are ready to proceed with the next speech, Gloria, we'll close the door, and you will have to wait until the next speaker if you're not in here. So please pay attention to the comings and goings. I'll give a signal, and we will move on as we go. I will introduce each speaker in turn. And so with no further comments, I'm going to introduce our first speaker, who's Kyle Good. The title of his speech is Food as Conscientious Objection.
As I was getting myself a cup of Earl Grey Equal Exchange tea the other day, I found something interesting on the side of the box. Where most companies would put a short, flowery explanation of the tea with a brief thanks to for the customer's support, I was instead met by a plea, "We need you." Compelled to read further, I found this. Our mission is more threatened today than it was 10 years ago. Climate change is wreaking havoc on our farmer partners. Corporate digestion of fair trade has both reduced the power of small farmers and has demoralized shoppers in the U.S. It's a difficult path ahead, but together we can move mountains. By succinctly summing up the world in where the world is regarding climate change and the food industrial complex, this short message appealed to me. Their marketing did the trick, a high-quality product wrapped in an affirming message that I'm making a difference. At the same time, this statement obscures the complexities surrounding our food system. As a product largely targeted at the middle-class liberal Westerners, it limits the conversation. All too often, economics and social pressures determine what, if, and when we eat. While this reality is seemingly unavoidable, it shouldn't control us. What we eat reflects how we relate to the environment and others. We must reframe how communities connect to food if we truly wish to address many of the social and political issues which we face today. Over the past decade and a half, awareness regarding the environment and climate change has grown tremendously. Yet steps taken both domestically and internationally seem too little. In Drawdown, a collection of research which outlines the top 100 actions to be taken to reverse global warming, 17 of them are food related, and two of the top five. Coming in at 3 and 4, food waste and switching to plant-rich diets, researchers propose that between these two, there would be a reduction of nearly 136 gigatons of CO2 released by 2050. But how do we get there? We've known consumerism counters the Gandhian mantra of live simply so that others may simply live, which Anabaptists have been tempted to embrace. Besides, scientists have been telling us similar things regarding climate change for the past few decades. While their data may shift slightly, the overall message stays the same. We're killing the Earth. We're destroying our children's future. Any solution becomes increasingly complex as we hurtle toward what appears to be inevitable destruction. Michael Pollan, in his essay, Why Bother?, proposes that with so many stories we can tell ourselves to justify doing nothing, the most insidious is that whatever we manage to do will be too little too late. He wrote that a decade ago. And the pace of change since does appear to be exactly that, too little too late. How is it that a decade later our progress seems so insignificant? I propose that this lack of change stems from an inability to connect food and community. While composting, biking, eating more plants, planting a garden, or buying eco-exchange tea all help, they're fundamentally doomed because they lack community and rely on a broken system. While they do represent conscientious objection to a system which abuses people and the earth, they aren't grounded in communities of support which enable them to grow. But how do we change this and engage our communities in ways that build solidarity instead of polarization? Soulfire Farm in upstate New York has begun building a model for this, for what this might look like. Founded with the intent of addressing food apartheid, Soulfire Farm serves disadvantaged communities in Albany, New York. They refer to this as feed people and soil, and their food is intensively cultivated on five acres using exclusively organic and ancestral practices that increase topsoil depth, sequester carbon, and increase soil biodiversity. In other words, combating climate change while building stable food networks and communities. Here we move away from the environmental implications to look at how food shapes our relationships with others. Food is naturally communal. It generates connections and helps to build our sense of community. Mennonites practice this through potlucks, but this only builds community at the end of the food's journey. Besides, this end-of-the-line community building remains within the denomination. If we enable food cultivation and consumption to transcend the racial the racial, political, economic, and religious divisions in our society, we will see change. In answer to the question of why, Michael Pollan argues that by planting a garden, you will begin to heal the split between what you think and what you do, to commingle your identities as consumer and producer. While I agree with Pollan that we must heal the rift between consuming and producing, I also believe that by healing our relationship with our land and our broader communities, that we will begin to heal other broken relationships. While buying Eco Exchange tea may make us feel that we're making a difference, the real measure of our impact is stability of those with the least in our communities. We won't achieve any lasting victory regarding climate change or our political and social issues unless we're willing to expand our definition of community to include food stability for all. By doing so, we will build networks and common ground which allow for conversations across belief systems and worldviews. We must object to the idea that simply being a conscientious objector is enough. While objection is necessary, it is only a starting point. There isn't any one formula for solving the issues we face. Instead, we must build communities which resist the systems of oppression and division. By giving alternative food systems legitimacy within our communities, we'll build areas of stability which positively impact the world around us. Thank you.
Our second speaker is Amanda Williams. Her title is Mother Earth's Plea for Her Prodigal Children to Return.
I would like to start out by asking a question. When was the last time that you killed a plant? My steps have led me down forgotten paths, deep within the swamps and over blazing dunes of sand. Among the green and golden havens, I journeyed with one purpose, to eradicate the invaders that threatened to transform my diverse ecosystem into a novel one. One of uniformity, with flora and fauna that matched the modern forests and dunes that already dotted my land. With the righteous power I had, I exchanged one life for another. In my mind, the wisteria vines that choked the young black cherry trees were just as much a threat to me as they were to the trees I was saving. Humans have impacted this world far more than any other species that has ever lived. Once the patient listeners to the trees and grateful friends of the land, we now cut and kill with our earbuds in and our minds far gone from the devastation and destruction of the natural world. Too easy is it to clear-cut a forest, trawl for a school of fish, or cut deep into the body of our planet to extract fossil fuels. We have lost our connection with our planet. Humanity has forgotten her roots. The notion of accountability for our actions to the earth have been misplaced, branded as indigenous. Today, these indigenous ideas, held by lovers of the land, provide our last chance to return from our prodigal journey back to the loving embrace of Mother Earth. I will never forget those long days I spent as a biological aide working to kill invasive plants for the state of Delaware. Unaware of the implications of my work, I willingly poisoned, slashed, and killed plants that I was told should not be there because they were invasive species. Thinking back now, I realized that the plants did not choose to be there. They were just trying to live. It was not their intention to invade the land as much as it was to outcompete their neighbors for resources and live long enough to make seeds to ensure that there will be a next generation. To be completely honest with ourselves, those plants probably got there from a bird, which probably ate the seeds of plants brought over from another country by a human. This problem with invasive species is obviously controversial. If we kill them, we are impacting the earth. If we leave them, we are impacting the earth. And this proves my point, that humans impact the earth in many ways. Yet this is just one way in which we do so. With our travel and constant movement, we have uprooted plants and animals into new ecosystems. We have changed the composition of the atmosphere and have ended the lifeline of many species, rendering them extinct. We have exploited our natural resources to the point of exhaustion and left nothing but toxic wastelands and areas where we sought precious metals. Whole mountaintops have been leveled and forests have been burned. Humans have always played a role on impacting the environment. In the beginning of our species' existence, we quickly became a keystone species, meaning we have the potential to change entire ecosystems. Many different plants and animals have come to rely on mutualistic relationships with humans. For example, the Native Americans' prized sweetgrass grows better after human disturbance than it would have if it was left alone, according to Robin Kimmerer, a Native American professor of botany at the State University of New York. According to Kimmerer, she writes of the long-gone relationship that humans and plants share. Her people, the Potawatomi, along with many other Native American bands, revere the plants and animals they live with. It is not a matter of resource management to them, but a matter of equality. Kimmerer wisely states that the plants are our teachers, which have been around much longer than us. They know how to create soil, recycle water, create homes for endless other beings. They give us the very air we breathe. They know how to make berries out of light. We might do well to listen, she says. To her people, plants are not just sustenance to be consumed. They are individuals which have the right to life just as much as we do. But today, many people have stopped respecting plants. In Genesis 1:26, God says, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." Typically, one would use this to say, ha, look at the power God has given humans over plants. But that is a very anthropocentric way of looking at it. It is not that we have power over plants, it's that we have been entrusted with the ability and responsibility to care for plants and all of life, which includes even those we have come to think of as a lesser species than us. What is interesting is that the Native Americans have known this all along. How do we get to a point where we value and respect plant life just as much as they do? We need to get away from the idea that we can disregard living beings just because they are plants or just because they are not humans. Life is a gift. Our original calling from God was to care for the earth, to look after her and all the living things that inhabit her, because Earth is our one and only home. I don't know if you noticed, but I don't see any friendly planets anywhere remotely close to here. One Native American Thanksgiving address wisely says, "We have been given the duty to live in balance and harmony with each other and all living things." So how do we, as mostly non-Native Americans, do this in a society that only cares about humans? How do we live peacefully with plants? Let's answer this question by thinking of the circle of life that we see in the fall season. Orange, yellow, and red leaves covering the ground are not only beautiful to look at, but are also essential to the survival of wintering insects, hibernating mammals, microorganisms looking for their next meal, and yes, plants. However, despite the beautiful circle of life that fall foliage brings, our society has deemed it as sloppy. Many of us rush outside with a rake in one hand and a plastic bag in another to quickly remove the leaves from our yards while the leaves are still falling. Move on to the spring, when we begin to remove the weeds and put in mulch. Before you get your hands dirty, think of all the hiding spots and food you are removing from the ground, only to be replaced by dead wood chips that choke out all life. These weeds, which we have come to recognize as unwanted plants, are in some cases historically herbal plants, which are edible to humans and many other animals. Their flowers are some of the first to come up for pollinators to feast on. They provide ground cover for snakes, rodents, and insects. They are also sequestering carbon, as little as it may be, and are filling the soil with nutrients. These two examples of leaving fallen leaves over the winter and not putting down mulch are simple steps you can take to live in peace with Mother Earth. By reclaiming the definition of beauty as anything that embraces the circle of life, you are embracing your God-given calling. I end with a story that hits close to home for me, and it speaks as a testament to what happens when we try to dominate plants. People back in my hometown of Millsboro, Delaware, did not take seriously the impacts of what too many nutrients in the soil has the potential to do. After years of dumping excess fertilizer onto crops, hoping to make them grow more, my neighbors are suffering from water contamination. A surplus of nitrates and phosphates are shown to have nasty side effects, which include lack of oxygen to tissues in your body and kidney disease. Nitrates and phosphates also induce the growth of harmful bacteria, such as E. coli. Now, many of my neighbors are getting their water wells tested to see if it is drinkable. Out of my experience, I challenge you to be more aware of what you are dumping onto your lawn, your field, or your land, because while it may be beneficial to get waste out of the house or fertilizer may help your crops grow faster for a while, everything we do has consequences. What you dump in your land, you or someone else will eventually either end up eating or drinking. So before spraying your yard with herbicides or loading your fields with nitrates and phosphates, think downstream. Think not only how it will affect other humans, but how it will impact the circle of life. Trying to induce plants to grow faster than they would naturally do so by using an excess amount of fertilizer is harmful for everything in the circle of life, including us. So I challenge you to dump your waste appropriately and use fertilizer only as needed. Be aware of sustainable practices like permaculture and incorporate them into your gardening or farming. God created us to be in relationship with Mother Earth, not take advantage of her. Things are supposed to be exploited, not people, not plants. Thank you.
Our third speaker is Katrina Poplett. Her speech is entitled, "When Silence is Betrayal, Climbing the Hill."
When silence is betrayal, climbing the hill. We found there were Mennonites totally unaware of the extent to which practices of segregation and racial injustice were being carried on in their community. We found those who were aware often reacted in this way. What can we do? We are non-resistant, so we can't boycott, picket, or sit in. What are we supposed to do? Dr. Vincent Harding wrote this after a visit to Eastern Mennonite College in 1962. Vincent, a Mennonite activist and civil rights leader, and Rosemary, his wife, were disappointed in the actions of Mennonites in Harrisonburg when it came to segregation and the fight for civil rights of African Americans. Yet, Harding returned to Atlanta to continue as the director of the Mennonite House, attempting to bridge the gap between the Mennonite church and the civil rights movement as an African American in both worlds. Harding wanted the Mennonite church to be accountable for its actions, mantras, and doctrines. The question is that even though he wrote letters and gave speeches imploring the church to speak out and stand against racism, did the Mennonite church ever listen or be accountable to their beliefs and values? Accountable to their beliefs and values, what would this look like? Accountability is a slippery concept, twisted into processes and proceedings, but rarely practiced with integrity. Defined by Oxford English Dictionary, accountability is the liability to answer or willingness to take responsibility for one's own action. Harding, in the excerpt I read above, was asking for those who saw segregation and racism to be accountable to African Americans in the Mennonite church and to the message of love, acceptance, and resistance of oppression the Mennonite church claimed as its mission. Accounting for one's actions is a principle of restorative justice. Restorative justice behooves us to involve victims, offenders, and communities when a harm has occurred, holding offenders accountable in making things as right as possible, according to Howard Zaire. The significance of restorative justice is growing, although today I want to focus on how the Mennonite Church has been called to address past and current harms they have inflicted, but have not yet taken responsibility for. According to the Mennonite Quarterly Review, a group of Mennonites from Goshen, Indiana, settled in Naxubee County, Mississippi in 1960. While at first the Mennonites were different than other white people in the area, the Mennonites swiftly colonized the land and people with surprising force and terrible consequences. For example, the Mennonites did not hire any help because of the mechanization they brought from the north, simultaneously pushing black people off their land and forcing them into worse economic situations than before their arrival. The first months and years of living there saw the Mennonites become assimilated to the mindset of the southern whites by segregating church services, having black hired workers eat on the back porch instead of inside, complaining that blacks were slow and incapable of work. The list goes on. On a tour of the Mennonite community in Mississippi, Guy Hirschberger, a member of MCC, was astonished to see how they assimilated quickly to the culture of the white South, according to the book Daily Demonstrators. In 1963, Hirschberger and Harding met to talk about the critical nature of the civil rights movement, according to Tobin Shearer's chapter in a larger volume. During this meeting, Harding voiced that the credibility of the Mennonite Church was at stake. Despite the calls to action, the church did not act. The lack of action was excused by the sentiment of, "We are non-resistant." Yet, as Harding pointed out, when an ABC liquor store came to Harrisonburg, Mennonites did not sit idly by. Harding was not shy about calling out this hypocrisy of the church. For years, he pleaded, advocated, and invited and begged the church consistently to take part in the civil rights movement. While the language of restorative justice was not yet developed, the church had opportunities to face their actions, or more precisely, their lack of action. Fast forward almost 60 years, and here we are in the midst of a world trying desperately to cling to good over evil. The Mennonite Church is in the thick of it, equipped with restorative facilitators and good intentions. But we are still failing. We are in debates over political issues that deny people dignity within our church. Donna Hicks writes that the 10 essential elements of human dignity are the acceptance of identity, inclusion, safety, acknowledgement, recognition, fairness, benefit of doubt, understanding, independence, and accountability. The lack of recognition of historically segregationist policies in the Mennonite Church is a microaggression towards people of color in our church. The debates over LGBTQIA inclusion in our churches is in itself denying the dignity of those who seek acceptance and love in a community of believers. We are denying those who want to be a part of the Mennonite Church simply by questioning their worth, their identities, their dignity. We have yet to address the historical harms and colonization left in the wake of Southern Mennonites who took land from African Americans in Mississippi. The problem Vincent Harding had that I uphold is this. While we are aware of what is happening as Mennonite institutions, we are failing to hold ourselves accountable. People of color, of queer identities, the list go on, yearn to be known by the church, but are met with discussions over whether or not the church should allow them through the doors. Part of EMU's mission is to bear witness to truth, compassionately serve, and firmly stand for nonviolence and peace, as Jesus called. In the March 1st, 2018 edition of the Weather Vane, a student of color is quoted saying, I found when I got here the advertisement of diversity of the student population and emphasis on social justice did not accurately reflect what living on campus was like. We must not ignore this reality any longer. The truth that students of color feel ostracized at EMU, they are voicing their realities, and it is now on us as an institution to listen and change. This is an opportunity to grasp. Use facilitators of restorative processes to know how people experience Mennonite institutions based on their positionality. This is what Vincent Harding called for the church to bear witness and be accountable to narratives of members of color within the Mennonite church. In his letter after visiting EMC, he offered the testimony of an African-American student whose parents were turned away from a motel. He went on to call out EMC for not upholding the call of Christ in allowing the student's hurt to go unministered to, which would allow that wrong to go uncorrected. In his own language, Harding called for EMC to address the harms and needs created by racial segregation and the lack of response and care shown to the parents and the student when they were not able to see him graduate. My friends, now is the time for action. In Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech, Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence, written by Harding, he says that although we have bounded knowledge, we must speak. This is true more than ever for Mennonite institutions. For a time has come when we must be accountable for our colonizing actions, our dignity-denying conversations, and the hypocrisy of our policies and advertising. We must look at how our silence, inaction, and lack of active support is keenly hurting members of our churches and communities. For even if it is our intention to be a people and place where Black Lives Matter and love is love, we must truly listen to the impact our systems and policies have on those whose positionality is threatened. We are capable of this. Our schools and churches are overflowing with peace builders and restorative justice practitioners. Let us not miss the moment to engage in a restorative process and dialogue as we missed with Vincent Harding. In their first act of directing the Mennonite House in Atlanta, Georgia, the Hardings wrote an advertisement called Climbers for a Southern Hill. They state the hill they live on is a metaphor for the work that will be done if one were to join their house. The Hardings wrote, "They urge us to come, not to carry them, not to patronize them, but simply to add our own lives to the brave company of persons who believe that God calls humans to a better way than the path of segregation, discrimination, and hatred." As a church community and as a university rooted in Christ's call to love radically, we must all become climbers of the hill to work towards accountability, witness, and reparation of past harms. For without understanding our past roles and harms, we cannot work towards a more just and peaceful world. After years of advocacy in the Mennonite church, Harding left discouraged and frustrated with the lack of action. There comes a time when silence is betrayal. So friends, join me in this climb, for it is that time.
Our next speaker is Lydia Haggard. And the title of her speech is It Black and White? Exploring Race in the Mennonite Church.
Being white is not a sin. Being Mennonite is not a sin. But participating in a system of violence and oppression is a sin. Some of you may be wondering, What am I doing as a white person talking about race in the Mennonite church in the United States? My answer is, I'm sharing my story as a young white Mennonite wrestling with big questions, trying to make sense of what I experience. Whether you are Mennonite or not, Christian or not, white or not, you are probably here listening because you are interested in peace. My story stems from a desire for peace, and I believe it is for anybody who is also seeking peace. I acknowledge that there are many minority groups who struggle to feel at home in the Mennonite church in the United States. Each one has their own story. Today, I am focusing on the writings of three African Americans, but I believe their words ring true for a larger population than only African Americans. After I tell a short personal story, I will share wisdom from three theologians, two of whom I feel particularly connected to since they grew up in my hometown. Finally, I will connect their wisdom to Mennonite values. As a Mennonite, I believe our denomination has a lot of work to do regarding racism and other forms of discrimination if we are going to claim the title Peace Church. I've grown up in a racist country where I hear about stories of racism all the time. Ironically, for me to really get it, I had to leave the country. It was in Jordan where I personally experienced feeling like an outsider. In Jordan, I was highly aware that my identity, with my white skin and American English, could be interpreted as a threat to the community, especially after President Trump made the controversial decision to move the United States Embassy to Jerusalem. Part of my identity was that I was part of the enemy country. The tension I felt was uncomfortable, and my muscles felt physically tight at the end of every day. Although I will never fully know what it means to be black in the United States, I had a taste of the fear connected to being judged based on my race. Being in a different country raised my awareness of prejudice and racism back in my home context of the United States. With this awareness, I sought out more information about how the church, specifically Mennonites in the United States, can help in fighting racism. I was led to three black theologians who helped me explore ideas of whiteness and blackness. Drew Hart, a black theologian and activist, defines whiteness as being more than skin color. He wrote a book in 2016 about racism in the church called Trouble I've Seen, Changing the Way the Church Views Racism. Hart writes, "Whiteness is a social construction, specifically about domination and violence." My initial response was defensive. I grew up Mennonite, believing in nonviolence, so how can my skin color define me as violent and dominating? Hart addresses people like me and other white Mennonites by asking the question, how did America become America as it is today? European immigrants displaced and murdered native peoples. European immigrants benefited from a system that enslaved Africans. This explanation helped me see that violence is a part of my history, whether I like it or not. Whiteness is not just about color, it is a way of living that thrives on violence. Blackness, too, is more than skin deep. James Cone is a black theologian and author of the book God of the Oppressed. He describes blackness as the experience of those on the margins of society who are oppressed by the dominating groups and systems. In other words, black is not white. By this definition, Cone makes the profound statement, Jesus is black. Although this may sound surprising at first, Cone uses a brief description of Jesus' historical life to justify his claim. Jesus was a poor man who lived a radical life proclaiming freedom for the oppressed. He was persecuted himself by the systems, both political and religious. And ultimately, he was murdered by those oppressors. Similarly, black Americans have been oppressed by both political systems and the church in the United States. According to Cone, this oppression arises even as black communities fight for liberation, the same message as Jesus. Cone goes further to say that Jesus is still present in the suffering of blacks as the least of these in American society. Cone concludes, the blackness of Christ is not simply a statement about skin color, but rather the transcendent affirmation that God has not ever, no, not ever, left the oppressed alone in struggle. So, as a Mennonite, what do I do with these definitions of whiteness and blackness? Many Mennonites in the United States, including myself, fall under the white category and are part of a system that harms brothers and sisters of color. How can white Mennonites be released from this system? I agree with Hubert Brown that the answer lies with our spiritual ancestors, the Anabaptists. Hubert Brown is author of the book Black and Mennonite. He grew up in a Mennonite church less than 1 mile from my house. He constantly wrestled with what it meant to be black and Mennonite. Although Brown criticizes Mennonites in the United States today, he applauds the original Anabaptist way of life. The Anabaptist interpretation of Jesus, he argues, is similar to Cone's black Jesus because they both reject the combination of church and state, the state being the root of the domination of violence and oppression in society. Anabaptists also practiced community living, which Brown believes gets to the heart of what it means to be a Christian. According to Brown, the Anabaptists did not merely talk about what it means to live a Christian life, they lived one. Because of their radical living and rejection of the institutional church, Anabaptists were persecuted and a suffering minority. Brown declares, Anabaptists were black. James Cone claims that Jesus is black, and Hubert Brown claims that Anabaptists were black. What about Mennonites today? Since Christians are descendants of Christ Jesus and Mennonites are descendants of Anabaptists, one might assume that Mennonites fall under the same black category. But on the contrary, the violent history of the United States has changed many Mennonites into oppressors living in whiteness. Brown criticizes white Mennonites for losing the spirituality and fervor that their Anabaptist ancestors had. Brown claims that African Americans in the 21st century have replaced the Anabaptists of the 16th century. Brown writes, I believe we poor folks, we black folks, the disinherited, the radical Christians, we are today's Anabaptists. According to Brown, black folks are the ones following the example of Jesus, seeking liberation and justice against the violent systems of society. Mennonites also claim they want to live out faith according to Jesus' teaching, but too often this desire does not lead to action. In the Mennonite Church USA Confession of Faith, Mennonites declare, led by the Holy Spirit, we follow Christ in the way of peace, doing justice, bringing reconciliation, and practicing non-resistance. As followers of Jesus, Mennonites say they aim to work for justice, especially by living out their faith in radical and practical ways. Mennonites also claim, we witness against all forms of violence and hostility among races and classes. Hubert Brown and Drew Hart would criticize many Mennonites who are not speaking out against the whiteness, which is interlinked with violence and hostility among races. Mennonites need to live out what they preach when it comes to racism in the church. Martin Luther King Jr. proclaimed, without justice, there can be no peace. It is time for Mennonites, who claim to be peacemakers, to make a new commitment to work for justice. White Mennonites, including myself, must begin by humbly admitting the sins of being part of a violent system. We need to hear again the voice of truth spoken by the oppressed, the same truth that the original Anabaptists experienced and lived. This journey towards justice will take decades of white Mennonites surrendering whiteness to listen to and support the fellow modern-day Anabaptists in their struggle. Having white skin is not a sin. Having Mennonite faith is not a sin. But insisting on being white in a system of violence and oppression is a sin. I commit a sin of injustice when I close my eyes to the suffering of my brothers and sisters. Join me, my fellow Mennonites and committed peace seekers, join me on this journey, following in the footsteps of Anabaptists and of Jesus, to speak out for justice and live out our faith.
And our fifth speaker is Winifred Gray Johnson. Her title is Finding Forgiveness, A Path Towards Healthy Relationships.
Matthew chapter 6, verse 14 to 15. For if you forgive other people when they sin against you, your heavenly Father will forgive you also. But if you do not forgive others their sin, your Father will not forgive your sins. I grew up with this Bible verse, the Christian faith, and being Christians were important to my parents. I was taught to be kind, humble, and especially forgiven. Because the consequence would be to not have God's forgiveness. Since we are all sinners, I need God's forgiveness to have his love, his blessings, to be one of God's children. This was not a lesson taught in ignorance. Like most Liberians, my parents had lived through a civil war. Therefore, they understood the difficulties of our world. My mom would often say, Winifred, life can be hard. You need God. Always have God. And when faced with challenges, seek God's help and persevere. I think this was my first big word, persevere. I hardly knew what it meant, but I got the message. I was to keep my heart clear of any grudges, any ill will, and in turn, God would forgive my sins and help me through life challenges. I lost my mom shortly after I turned 17. She had battled and lost to pancreatic cancer. I cannot accurately describe or put into words what it means to feel, what it means to lose a parent. Not in a way that anyone in this room could fully comprehend. What I will say is that when she passed away, I was heartbroken. My world had shattered. This was not a challenge. A few months later, I would become a victim of sexual assault. These harsh realities of life erased the novelty of God and the innocence I once had. I never imagined that these were the challenges of life. Yes, you hear of people dying, you hear of assault victims, but you never really get it. At 16, I lived in a utopia. My challenges were making good grades in school, being active in church, and biggest of all, getting out of home chores. I remember praying to God to help me get out of having to wash dishes. Admittedly, this was a naive way of thinking. Therefore, when faced with real life challenges, I was shocked, ill-prepared for these harsh realities, and angry at the world around me, angry at my mom for leaving, and sure, this was beyond her control, but tell that to a 16-year-old whose family has survived a civil war. At some point, I lived with an illusion of invincibility. I was angry at myself for not being smarter, but really, I was angry at God. Scholars define forgiveness as an inner process central to psychotherapy where the injured person, without request of the other, releases those negative feelings and no longer seeks to hurt, self-destruct, or otherwise. This process has psychological and emotional benefits. My initial thoughts as I began writing this speech was to explore the potential benefits of forgiving my offender, to let go of this grudge that can be ever so crippling. I recognized through my Christian upbringing and years of counseling the power of forgiveness. Without forgiveness, there would be no reconciliation. I would remain in this web of hate, depression, failure, and sometimes a lack of will to live. However, And as though it was an epiphany, I soon discovered that while I do still hold a grudge and have not reconciled with my offender, the true anger I needed to let go of was my anger at God. This thought terrified me immensely. How could I have the audacity, I who am not worthy of his presence? How ungrateful must I be? Was this arrogance and disrespect to God? The scripture Deuteronomy 6:24 tells us of the Lord's command to obey all his decrees and to fear the Lord our God so that we might always prosper and be kept alive. Had I lost all sanity by admitting to being angry and sometimes resenting God? As a mere human, did I dare to say, God, I forgive you? I remind you of a familiar story about a man who lived righteously and in God's abundance, abundance of children, wealth, and happiness. Suddenly, he lost it all, his children, his riches, his health. In his hurt, desperation, and confusion, he cried out to God in confrontation. The story of Job is a good example that when harm has been done and we are hurt, we can confront God. It is allowed. Because, and here's the good news, God responds, and then he restores. So here's my truth. I was disappointed in God. I felt let down. And there were days that I did, in fact, resent God. I had lost my mom, my best friend, and I believed he could have saved her. I had been afraid to own that truth. Now I realize the sooner I admit this to myself, the sooner I can truly begin to heal. Otherwise, I'll continue to suffer in silence and exist in unhealthy relationships, the most important being my relationship with God. Because at a very fundamental level, I was being dishonest with myself. Somewhere along the way, I had also forgotten my mother's message to persevere. I realized it was time to forgive and reconcile with God. In his book, Reconcile, John Paul Lederach suggests love and compassion as the center to reconciliation. He draws from the scripture, Matthew 22:37, that teaches us to love our God with all our heart, all our soul, and all our mind, and love our neighbor as ourselves. As a step in this process, he highlights the importance of forgiveness and writes, where forgiveness is needed, be the first to ask for it. Where forgiveness must be given, do so graciously. I am still on my path to finding forgiveness and building healthier relationships, but I believe for the very first time in 6 years, I am heading in the right direction. As I conclude, I leave you with these challenges. If you are privileged to not be hurting, reach out to others who might be. Let God use you to be his response to someone who could be questioning him, who could be confronting him, someone who needs his assurance. In an effort to stand in solidarity with people who are hurting, the International Student Organization on campus is hosting a fundraiser on April 19 for sexual assault victims in the Congo. Consider giving your support to these victims. If you have been harmed and are yet to heal, ask yourself incredibly difficult questions, even the ones with answers that are scary, in order to identify the true source of the hurt you feel. Be radically honest with yourself. You must be. Only then can you begin the process of forgiving, an important factor in our Christian faith. As Max Ehrman famously write, be at peace with God. In the noisy confusion of life, keep peace with your soul.
Our sixth speaker is Caleb Schrockhurst. The title of his presentation is This a Bonhoeffer Moment? Asking the Right Questions in Trump's America.
A few months ago, I was walking to class, and I saw a magazine sitting out in the Bible department lounge that caught my eye. Staring in shades of red from the cover of Sojourner's magazine was Dietrich Bonhoeffer, famous German theologian and resister of the Nazi Party, martyred as a traitor to the Nazi state. Accompanying his stern face was the title, Is This a Bonhoeffer Moment? Now, I was actually pretty shocked. Though not outrightly stated anywhere in the magazine, Sojourner's was basically asking if Trump's rise to power is similar enough to Hitler's to make us concerned as Christians. Though to some this is a rather bold and shocking question, right now it is a conversation we need to be having. During Bonhoeffer's day, the mainstream German church embraced the ruling political party just as the mainstream American church has embraced the Republican Party today. During Bonhoeffer's day, the mainstream German church looked the other way while racism and violence crept in and took hold in their churches, just as is happening in the mainstream American church today that turn away refugees, support anti-Islamic, anti-Hispanic, segregationist, and other racist policies, and support and glorify military service. During Bonhoeffer's day, the German state became an integral part of the worship that took place in churches. And today, we can find American flags right beside the pulpits in churches all across these United States. The parallels between the Christians of Bonhoeffer's Germany and Trump's America are not merely passing comparisons. Yet despite all these things that remind us of Bonhoeffer's day, asking if this is a Bonhoeffer moment is ultimately the wrong question. Yes, we should be shocked at the state of the American church and never settle for accepting state worship and Eurocentrist neocolonialism as aspects of our faith. But calling today a Bonhoeffer moment reduces both Bonhoeffer and ourselves. Ultimately, asking if this is a Bonhoeffer moment is wrong for three reasons. First, it implies violence may be the answer in the face of political problems. Second, it cheapens the difficulty and daily struggle of working for peace. And third, it diminishes the radical nature of Jesus and other church leaders, in particular our Anabaptist forefathers and mothers. First of all, this is the wrong question because it implies violence may be the solution. Though Bonhoeffer was an outspoken critic of Hitler from the outset, giving his first address against him just 2 days after he took power, Bonhoeffer didn't succeed in creating a large enough political or religious movement to actually stand against the Nazis. Though he was an important founder of the Confessing Church, an anti-Nazi church movement, and later a spy in the German resistance. Yes, his sound biblical preaching against the Nazis and actions of resistance resonate with us today. But in his own day, it was not enough to keep the majority of German Christians from allowing and perpetrating genocide without renouncing their Christian beliefs. Eventually, Bonhoeffer joined the secular and violent resistance movement, contradicting his earlier pacifistic teachings. Though his involvement with the violent aspects of the resistance is still somewhat debated by scholars such as Eastern Mennonite Seminary's own Mark Thiessen Nation, Bonhoeffer was tried and killed for his documented work against the regime in a resistance movement that was undoubtedly an endorser of violence. Had Bonhoeffer continued preaching against the Nazi state without formally joining the resistance that endorsed violence, he may have lived through the war and become a central leader and witness for peace and reconciliation in post-war Germany. Instead, he died at the hands of the state he was trying to save from itself. He compromised his previously deeply pacifistic teachings in order to seek a political change, and he paid his life for it. In addition, perhaps Bonhoeffer's seemingly contradictory choice to support assassination for Hitler is what makes him so fascinating to modern-day pacifists. How could someone work their whole life for peace and then support violence? Is it some closet desire of pacifists to find thinkers like Bonhoeffer who support pacifism in theology, but then yield to temptation and embrace violence? I think it is exactly that, a temptation to think that violence will solve our political problems. The fact is, glorifying Bonhoeffer for his Anabaptist leanings ignores this huge mar on his record. It doesn't mean we can't learn from him, but it does mean we need to continue considering where our theology needs to be in order to not yield to the temptation of violence, even in times that call for extreme action. A second major problem with asking if today is a Bonhoeffer moment is that it implies there's a single moment we need to be looking for, dramatically reducing the emphasis that should be placed on the everyday work that peace and Christianity demands. Is the world really so much worse off today than it was 2 years ago that today is a Bonhoeffer moment and 2 years ago wasn't? In reality, peace should be the central work of our lives every moment, not just in moments of extreme duress. Yes, Charlottesville, the Muslim ban, turning away refugees, and so many other actions since Trump took office bring hate to the forefront. But racism and various forms of Islamophobia were still a huge part of this country under Obama. Visible moments of injustice like we're going through now may accentuate and accelerate the need for our work, but we must never become complacent and allow forces of hate to be normalized and ignored even during the best of times. If we wait for a Bonhoeffer moment, we will be too late. Finally, asking if today is a Bonhoeffer moment and not a Jesus moment is diminishing precisely what Jesus was all about, as well as the thousands of other Christian martyrs. Bonhoeffer's theology did lead to his death, but so did Jesus's. However, Jesus was killed for rebelling theologically, not just against the Romans, but also against his people's complacent religion and for his refusal to join one of their resistance movements. Bonhoeffer got to two of those three things. He rebelled against the government and complacent theology, but he did support a militant movement. If only there were some other European theologians who were martyred for their beliefs, but who didn't resort to violence. And of course, there are too many to count. Isn't one of our distinctive texts the Martyr's Mirror, telling story after story of those who died for their rebellion against complacent religion and corrupted government? Why is today a Bonhoeffer moment and not a Michael Sattler moment, a Felix Mons moment, a George Blaurock moment, a Jesus moment? Is that not exactly what it is? If Christianity is not always precisely about what Jesus, Bonhoeffer at his best, and the Anabaptist martyrs stood for, righting the injustice, violence, and oppression in society, then Christianity is lost. To quote Shane Claiborne, Christianity is at its best when it is peculiar, marginalized, suffering, and it is at its worst when it is popular, credible, triumphal, and powerful. We should always be working toward and remembering this, shunning the credibility and popularity that mainstream politicized Christianity brings us, and instead searching out the suffering margins to be true not just to Jesus, but also to Sattler, Mons, Blaurock, Simons, and yes, Bonhoeffer. If we wait for a time when this will be credible, triumphal, and powerful, then we will never act. To conclude, we can agree with Bonhoeffer's theology, his desire for peace and justice, and his courage in the face of death, but we can never stop short and allow his witness alone to become our go-to resistance story. Instead of asking if this is a Bonhoeffer moment, we need to be asking if this is a moment to resist injustice, if this is a moment to work for peace, if this is a moment to follow in the footsteps of countless martyrs. We must not ask if we're living in a Bonhoeffer moment. We must ask if we are living in a Jesus moment. And the resounding answer must be, and always has been, yes. Thank you.
But let us now listen to our seventh speaker, Fabiana Espinal. The title of her speech is Creativity as a Path to Healing and Connection.
The last time I cried in public was at the funeral of my high school classmate when I was 17 years old. There have been many circumstances throughout my life since that time where it would have been perfectly acceptable, natural, and even expected for me to cry in front of several people. Yet for whatever reason, I was physically incapable of externalizing my emotions. Imagine my surprise when I recently found myself in a room full of complete strangers, unable to control the tears streaming down my face as the final monologue of a film was being delivered. The character speaking was a father trying to offer his heartbroken son some comfort, encouraging him to sit with his pain as long as he needed rather than to numb it. And as he said the words, we rip out so much of ourselves to be cured of things faster than we should, but to feel nothing so as not to feel anything. What a waste. I turn to the woman sitting next to me and lock eyes with her, and she is also in tears. We do not exchange any words, but in the look that passes between us, I feel more understood and connected to this stranger in this moment than I ever have to others with far greater insights on my life. Creative expression produces some of the most genuine bonds, no matter how fleeting, that we have the privilege to experience in our lifetime. Creativity is not limited to a particular subject or field. It can be found in every corner of the universe, in every life, and every day. So why does this matter? Why is creativity relevant when the earth is being abused and her children slaughtered? Because in order to heal her, we must first learn to work together. We must learn to communicate and connect with those we have nothing in common with. Beyond that, we have to develop the ability to humanize whom we see as the enemy. At their core, isn't that what the products of our imagination are? A reflection of our humanity. The fact that I am able to see myself in the thing you created should be proof enough that our God meant for this to be a gift of peace and unity. Mexican-American actress and activist Carla Sosa gave a TEDx talk in her hometown on June 3, 2015. In her talk, she described a time at the end of her first year of film school when she lost her voice. With seemingly no explanation or trigger, she lost the ability to make any kind of sound or speak even a single word for 3 whole months. Doctors were incapable of explaining the phenomenon and unable to predict when it would end or how to make it better. Amidst great frustration and desperation, she spiraled to the point of wanting to take her own life. Carla said she turned to everything she thought would sustain her during hardship. Her family, her friends, her ambition, her faith, and nothing. It was during her lowest point that Carla's pain became eased when she noticed how her torment was reflected in art. Plays and films, paintings and poetry filled the silence and saved her life. My own voice felt as though it had been taken away for a long time while I struggled to navigate an undiagnosed chronic pain condition since childhood, as well as the mental health consequences that accompany not knowing the source of your pain, not having anyone to validate it. I found myself in need of the words of others to say what I could not. I found myself in need to express that which could not be expressed with words alone. I became reliant on the different fantasy stories and the escape they provided when it was all too much. It was then, like Carla, that I became aware that my pain had been felt before. What a revelation to see that your pain, no matter what you're going through, has been deeply felt and documented by people through time and across oceans. Imagine what that does for someone in need of a voice. The interesting thing about emotions like anger and grief is that we convince ourselves that we are alone in our misery, outsiders, suffering as the world continues to turn. We can never fully experience someone else's life as they do, yet there's this deep empathic understanding when I see the disturbing isolation and body dysmorphia illustrated in the self-portraits of young photographer Francesca Woodman. I can almost imagine the poet Nayir Wahid sitting next to me at night as she writes, "Cry wild, you have probably never cried wild, but you know what doors feel like. You have an intimacy with doors that is killing you." The girl from my class playing the piano somehow knows I'm happy today. She moves her hands across the keys in a sweet song I do not recognize, but nonetheless feels like it was composed just for me, just to describe the lightness I feel in that particular moment. People I assumed live realities removed from my own gave me mediums to express the things stuck in my throat, the things that make my chest hurt and my stomach double over, the things that make my face ache from smiling. They fill my soul and show me the empathy I crave from the world, but knew not how to ask for. Isn't it amazing how we are all born creative beings, that it is not something to be taught, but nurtured? We were wonderfully made with the ability to craft entertaining, useful, valuable, beautiful things. When we think of creative work, our minds might gravitate towards the writers, the musicians, the artists. Robert DeHaan, however, a retired Emory University cell biologist, advocates for science to be seen as a creative quest as well. In science, you're constantly exploring questions with unknown answers. DeHaan emphasizes that it takes a great level of creative thought to solve these kinds of problems. He says science is more about being curious about the world and marveling at the creativity of nature rather than a series of facts to be memorized. Answering the types of questions that change the course of humankind requires creative thinking. Creativity provides a path for the healing of the self and of the world. There is a reason creative measures are incorporated in therapeutic and restorative efforts across disciplines. This extraordinary resource helps us eradicate the separation we feel within ourselves. When we create, we tap into all the things we work so hard to keep hidden. Creating makes us vulnerable, stealthily weaving out the things that make us human, the things that make us realize that what we hate about ourselves, about others, are nothing more than our humanity lacking healing and connection. I do not mean to oversimplify grave crisis, both personal and global, by suggesting everything can be fixed and we can live in a perfect world if we would only be more creative. What I want to leave with you is that it is no accident that our species has the capability of creative thought, the capability of admiring and using what it yields. Bringing restoration and transformation to the chaos we live in begins with learning to bond through our pain and joy. Creativity makes it possible to bridge that gap between us and them, me and you. Realizing that when our feelings bleed out of our bodies, they look astoundingly similar. It is not restrained by language or skill or age. It does not discriminate based on race, religion, gender identity, or sexual orientation. Isn't it time we recognize the power the path of creativity holds? What I would give to see a world more connected, more whole, intentionally using this gift to say, I see you. Thank you.